Thank you. Good afternoon. As you heard, this is the news. On background, acute HIV infection is the period of peak infectiousness for HIV and has higher risk of transmission per sexual or drug sharing act, or needle sharing act. Antibody at this point is not yet detectable. Virus is detectable. But one way includes by nucleic acid amplification testing. And identifying AHI cases and interrupting disease transmission during this acute period is an important disease control strategy. The New York City Department of Health Sexually Transmitted Disease Clinics are 8 in number. The services are free and confidential and on a walk-in basis, available 6 days per week. We'll take care of anybody 12 years of age and above without regard to insurance status or immigration status, and we have about 88,000 patient visits per year. Our goal at the STD clinics is to make sure that each patient leaves the clinic knowing his or her current HIV status. HIV testing is part of the general medical consent and has an opt-out provision. And we provide rapid HIV antibody testing on site. We do about 60,000 such tests per year. And we do acute HIV testing by nucleic acid amplification for specific patients. I'll get to those in a minute. Our AHI screening efforts at the STD clinics has changed over the years. In 2007, we began screening all patients in the STD clinics for AHI. And we found that the costs were high and the yield was low. The characteristics of AHI cases diagnosed in our clinic suggested that we could do it more strategically, and we developed new screening criteria and began using it in 2010. And the criteria that we've been using since 2010 include one of the following criteria being true in the last 2 months prior to visit: sex with a known HIV-positive partner, or a man who's had sex with men, MSM, or woman who's had sex with MSM, sex with needle drug user, exchange sex for money or drugs, used injection drug works, or a victim of sexual assault. Any one of those combined with a negative rapid HIV antibody test on the day of visit is criteria for AHI screening. So the objectives of what I'm presenting today are to quantify our AHI case finding in the STD clinics, describe AHI cases identified, and to measure the contribution of STD AHI cases to New York City's HIV morbidity in the period of 2010 to 2012. Our data sources were the STD clinic electronic medical record, the New York City HIV/AIDS Surveillance Registry, which I'll refer to as HARS. We evaluated characteristics of the AHI cases, and we looked at trends. So this is the number of cases diagnosed in 2010, 2011, and 2012. And although the numbers of HIV cases being diagnosed has been decreasing slightly over the years, it's remained between 450 and 550 cases per year. What you can see is this red is representing the AHI-only cases, and what's below, the blue, represents everything other than the AHI cases. And you can see, even eyeballing it, that the proportion of all the cases that we diagnose that are AHI cases has been increasing. If we take a look at who those AHI cases were, there were 122 in number. 99% of them were male, all MSM. The median age was 26 years. And if we look at the cases by race, ethnicity, you can see by this pie chart representing the full 122 that about two-thirds of them were consisted of black and Hispanic men. If we look at the borough of residence of those cases, from the STD clinics shown in gray, and from other sources of AHI cases reported from across the city, they have in common the fact that the most cases come from Manhattan, followed by Brooklyn. If we look at other STD diagnoses concurrent to those AHI diagnoses over the time period, here you have the percent of AHI cases diagnosed with the following. There were 12% diagnosed with gonorrhea, 15% with chlamydia, 7% with syphilis of any stage, and 11% came as a result of being an STD contact. If we look at the STD clinic contribution to citywide HIV reporting, over that three-year period, there was a total of 10,214 reports of HIV received at the health department. 11% came from the STD clinics. If we look at the 643, the subset of 643 that were reports of acute HIV, 21% came from the New York City STD clinics. So, in summary, the STD clinic AHI screening accounts for a growing proportion of the HIV diagnoses that we are making in our STD clinics. Our cases are predominantly young, minority, and MSM. And STD clinic-based AHI screening contributes substantially to acute HIV case finding in New York City. And in conclusion, AHI screening in the New York City STD clinic setting is clearly a valuable tool for identifying the most infectious HIV cases. AHI screening may have similarly high impact in STD clinics in other jurisdictions. And rapid point-of-care testing for AHI would truly facilitate identifying recently infected persons. In addition to my co-authors, I'd like to acknowledge Dennis Nash for his thoughtful comments, and I'd like to thank you for your attention.
Thank you, and thank all the authors for these really interesting presentations. These papers are now open for questions and comments. Do we have another microphone, or so people can hear the questions? Well, so if you could please, when you ask a question, stand and say your name and where you're from when you ask the question. And since you're probably going to be directing questions to specific authors, can you please immediately say which author you want to address so that they'll know to listen carefully to your question? And when you're answering the questions, could you please repeat the question since people may not be able to hear it without a microphone? Anne.
Yeah. Hi, Anne O'Leary from CDC. It's for Susan Blank. So these were not pooled samples that you tested. They were just individual samples?
Those were pooled.
They were pooled, okay. And I thought it was interesting that you don't look at symptomatology at all. Has that just not panned out for you? Or
symptoms of acute HIV?
Of acute HIV infection.
You know, when we've looked back on interview over
wow.
half or
oh,
four.
Actually,
yeah. Sorry.
Looking back on symptoms, you mean as a screening criterion?
Yeah.
You know, the truth is that many patients don't really put it together until afterwards, and then we only get about half of the patients telling us that they, oh yeah, you know, I did have something a while back ago. But we found that these criteria, you know, compared to when we were doing universal testing, we're finding just as many cases and doing far fewer pooled tests. And although targeting isn't the subject of today's discussion, we've been able to save huge amounts of money by doing targeted testing. And yeah, you know, those symptoms, especially, you know, in the winter time when there's a lot of stuff that's going on. I mean, it's just not sensitive and not particularly specific.
So it hasn't panned out when people try to.
I mean, if people come in and they say those magic words, we'll of course jump on it, but these are really the criteria that have been the most fruitful for us.
So, can I ask a question also? Since you're up. Another question. So you might have said this in your presentation, but I missed it, I think. Two questions. One, do you know how many people had acute HIV infection who, I mean, how sensitive is your algorithm? Could you tell? You might have said that and I missed it. And then the second question is, given that you're going to start using PrEP among at least some people, or offering at least some people PrEP, so what do you, are you going to use that same algorithm for identifying acute HIV infection? Because certainly the consequences of missing acute HIV infection when you give somebody PrEP or will be, could be substantial.
Well, I think as far as PrEP, when we get to that point, the criteria for PrEP that we're using are based on the New York State guidelines. You won't be getting PrEP at the STD clinic. You certainly won't be getting PrEP from the STD clinics without having an acute HIV test.
That's what I, so you're going to do acute, okay.
Okay, but our criteria will still hold.
Thank you. This question is actually for Dr. Desjarlais. You had a slide that showed an increase in intravenous drug use for the white population and Latino population, but a decrease among the Black population. Can you explain what you attribute this decrease to? Because I know within the MSM population, in the Black community in New York City, there's been an increase. So.
The short answer is crack cocaine, that we see more African Americans using crack, not injecting, and fewer African Americans injecting drugs over time. You know, this goes back to the 1990s when the crack epidemic was sort of getting underway, and that hit the African American community much harder, and we've actually seen a substantial number of African Americans quit injecting to go to smoking crack or inhaling heroin or cocaine and such. So it's not that we have necessarily fewer African American drug users, but there's been a more of a pronounced shift from injecting to non-injecting drug use in the African American community. And I don't have the data to present here, but HIV rates among African American crack users are substantially higher than among African Americans who inject drugs.
Anybody can answer this, but I was reading the PARTNER study that talked about HIV transmission with a decreased viral load or undetectable viral load. Several of you talked about HIV. Would you comment on that study, or what is the message on the whole undetectable viral load and how that decreases the HIV transmission from positive PARTNER to negative?
Okay, so it showed that the HIV early treatment, are you talking about the trial on early treatment?
No, I was talking about, there's so many messages.
Yeah, so, okay. Yeah, undetectable viral load right now seems to kind of, okay, so there's been a review recently, and it's sure that if you look at the actual data that are available, the likelihood of transmitting with the undetectable viral load is extremely low, but there's not enough data now to say that it's close to nil. Okay, the recent meta-analysis. Okay, let's say over a 10-year period in a couple. Okay, would put the upper limit of transmission at 4%. Okay, but the actual observed transmission is less than 1% over 10 years. Within discordant couples when viral load is undetectable.
I'd just add that the next stage of HIV prevention in New York is really trying to get as many people on ART as possible. The City Health Department has an official goal that 80% of people will go from their first diagnosis of HIV to viral suppression within 12 months. So an extremely ambitious goal, and hopefully the City Department of Health will come close to achieving that.
Hi, I have two questions for Eric Chow. Yeah, I'm Emily Westheimer from New York City Health Department. Two questions. One question was how you picked the date cutoff for your quarterly versus monthly, because it didn't seem that it lined up with the change in the regulations. So I'm wondering if you did the analysis where it, maybe I actually read the slide wrong, but I was wondering if you did the analysis where you actually looked at the, using that change in regulation as the date cutoff for the quarterly versus monthly. And then the other question I had was whether, so it looks like to me there was no change to female sex workers in terms of the prevalence of infections, but in MSM and male sex workers, it seemed to have gone up with the change to quarterly testing. So I wondered if there was recommendations that MSM and male sex workers were tested monthly and gone back to the monthly testing.
Thank you for your question. So the date was set on the 6th of October 2012. So that is the date of legislation has been changed. So the data analysis was divided into two periods. The monthly period will be the year before the date of legislation change, and the quarterly period will be the year after. So for your second question, the current screening regulation is just for sex workers, but not for MSM. And for male sex workers, we find that there are lots of challenges like doing screening on male sex workers, because in Victoria, there are, most of the male sex workers were working privately, so they are not working in the brothels. So there is a recent study showed that just only 2% of the brothels offer male sex workers. So most of the MSM also occasionally sell sex, and that's why the quarterly and quarterly screening regulation doesn't apply very effectively on male sex workers.
Thank you. So this question is for Melina, and actually it's sort of two questions. The first one being your suggestion for interventions, I'm assuming that you meant for them to be while they're incarcerated. Or, and then the second question has to do with what are your thoughts then, given some of the fairly incredible determinants of health, shall we say, that these girls are facing. What do you think about the sustainability of an intervention that's in the incarcerated setting, and then they go back out into an environment that is not conducive to health in so many ways?
That's a great question, and I was a bit rushed, pardon me. But actually, the importance of transitional care and follow-up after release is critical. So yes, usually the interventions, I mean, we're working with a number of different partners currently, both within custody and after release. So yes, our DPH staff are, they're not DIS, but they're sort of like DIS and very, very targeted at this population. So we would hope to initiate in the moment, for example, a immediate referral to a trained therapist from our Department of Mental Health who is assigned to each of those three halls. There's one who specifically works with these girls and a few boys as well. But then, yes, it's a comprehensive effort. So we've had to look for partners in non-traditional public health partnerships, such as the juvenile courts, our county council, our public defenders, so lawyers, Department of Mental Health, Department of Child and Family Services. We're working very closely with a number of areas of juvenile probation. So this is a very broad-based effort. In addition to community-based organizations and advocacy, there are a couple of advocacy groups that have survivor advocates who can be immediately linked. And so absolutely. We're really this is a very nascent kind of effort, and we're figuring it out. There's an enormous amount of research and documentation and review and analysis that needs to be done to appropriately inform effective interventions, but we're sort of on our way.
I won't yell. My name is Daniel Pohl. I'm from Howard Brown Health Center in Chicago. Sue, my understanding is that your overall incidence of HIV in New York City is going down based on your diagnosis data. Is that correct?
We're just the STD.
Not overall then? Yes or no?
Yes.
Okay. And so I guess my question then is, to what do you attribute finding more acute HIV infection in your STD clinics in the last 3 years using the same technology? Are you getting more high-risk people in? Are they coming in sooner after a high-risk activity? How are you finding more people with acute HIV infection now?
Thank you.
Actually, I could go back to one of the slides. While in New York City, yes, reported cases of HIV has been decreasing over the last few years. What the data that I showed was the proportion of the HIV cases within the clinics that are diagnosed that are AHI cases. Yes? Yes. Yes. Yes, they went up a little bit per year, and the non-acute cases did go down. And so what do we attribute that to? Well, it's hard to say, although, you know, I think the word on the street is out there that we do offer testing for acute HIV. We've also begun offering post-exposure prophylaxis for HIV. And although that's not something that we have advertised, but really have made our patients, you know, aware of it while they're there, I think that over time that's going, you know, I think that we are getting an accretion of very high risk individuals who are coming to us for services. And you know what, and the other thing is that they can do it fairly quickly. They can walk in and, you know, leave an hour and a half later, whenever they choose, really.
Great. Michelle Decker from Johns Hopkins, and this is a follow-up question as well for Melina. I'm wondering about, as you're sort of understanding the women that are involved, or the young girls really that are in commercial sexual exploitation, I'm wondering what you can tell us about some of their other access to health services, or just anything that, you know, maybe missed opportunities for identifying these women before they came. I mean, thankfully they're with you, but, you know, where can we be catching them a little bit earlier? Or do you get the sense they're just so isolated, being underage, that they're not reachable? Thanks.
Actually, thanks very much for the question. One of the few places that these traffickers will take the girls, the kids, boys or girls, and allow them to get access are community health centers. That's their commodity, needs to be in good shape. And so they will drop them off. They will drop them off at Planned Parenthood. They will drop them off sometimes at an emergency department. And so that's been an additional part of our sort of partnership and our outreach and our effort in Los Angeles and throughout California, is to make sure that community providers at all levels are prepared, are trained, and are on alert, are doing the screening. You know, these kids will be brought again and again and again. And if you never ask them these key questions, you're never going to get it. They're not going to volunteer this, because they are trained so intensively to keep this a secret. They are so isolated, both sort of literally and psychologically and emotionally. So, yeah, great question.
I'm Kyle Anderson from Indianapolis, Indiana. My question would be for Melina. Is there any conversation with, like, the BICE unit and the juvenile justice system? I know in Indiana we're moving to anyone who's arrested under the age of 18 for sex work is being treated as a human trafficking victim. And with that opens a lot more resources and also follow-up. And I guess with my second question, doing that you have the transitional living, do you see that with those additional services as being identified as a human trafficking victim and also not having the charges attached to you as a juvenile, would that have a long-term impact on the individuals you see?
It sounds like we're in a similar stage, actually, so we don't have any long-term effect yet. We've seen nothing, but we're working in the same direction. So, yes, law enforcement's involved. We've got a first responder protocol that ensues upon identification, whether they're going to be picked up for prostitution or just somebody out on the street suspects. They will grab them, and then immediately, within 90 minutes, there will be an advocate who will stay with that person through the initial 72-hour process at minimum. We've got a medical hub that they'll be prioritized to, where their county providers are prepared. And in addition, the DCF, our Children and Family Services, will appear. So we are working in layers, but I think, you know, this is new for everyone. It's very new for law enforcement to come and talk to the public health people and talk to the social workers, and they're used to security and control and, you know, sort of charging. And so this is really a paradigm shift that we're looking at.
I'm going to ask one question. This is for Michelle. I was struck by the difference in the data that were collected by the DHS versus the other data sources, obviously. And so my question is, what are the implications of that for, I mean, so many researchers rely on the DHS results. It's a bit troubling.
Yeah, the problem with the DHS, as far as I'm concerned, is related to the fact that the HIV and sexual behavior component is merged within something much bigger. And then, you know, and it comes mixed with other things, and, you know, people are less concerned. They are not told that this thing is about HIV, this questionnaire and everything. So the example that I know the best is the one in Benin, where, you know, even in face-to-face interviews, but telling people that this is a survey about HIV and about sexual behavior, we have 10 times more report of being a client of sex worker than they have in the DHS. And this seems particularly true for men. The other thing that is in this particular case could have had an impact as well. We had also a prevalence of HIV that was about 3 to 4 times higher in men. In women, there was not big difference, but in men, for the city of Cotonou, in our study, we had 3 times the prevalence that they had in the DHS. And if you look closely to the DHS, they had a very good response rate for women. They had, for the whole country, a very good response rate for men. But if you look at the specific data for the capital city, where you have the most HIV, they had about 30% of the men who did not answer the question, and 35 or 40% were not tested, whereas this was only 10% in our study. So, and these, you know, when you look at these data closely from the DHS, you know, the thing is that it's not always so easy in their reports to see the actual response rate if you try to work it out, and it's more difficult, it becomes very difficult if you go down to the level of specific regions or cities of the countries.